voiceless one to be heard. Support the show and WBAI by donating at give2wbai.org. That's the word give, the number 2, at wbai.org. Or by calling 212-209-2950. That's 212-209-2950. You can support the show and the station even more by going to give2wbai.org and giving a monthly donation of as little as $10 per month as a WBAI buddy to your favorite show on WBAI 99.5 FM.
And that's where your dial is set, 99.5 FM, WBAI New York, streaming at WBAI.org. Time now for the Joy of Resistance with Fran Locke and Halsey Hazard.
Joy of Resistance. We're sisters of the Joy of Resistance. No corporation, government, religion, husband, father, brother, gonna define our existence. Joy of Resistance. We have found the joy in resistance. For those who gain by keeping women down, we say your numbers up, don't underestimate our persistence. Keeping organized together, we have come a long distance. Joy, joy of resistance. Sisters of the joy of resistance. No corporation, government, religion, husband, father, brother, gonna define our existence. Joy.
And good evening. This is the Joy of Resistance, Multicultural Feminist Radio at WBAI. My name is Fran Luck, and I'm here with Halsey Hazard. And we bring you every week we are on the air, that is, the best we can of the front lines of women around the world fighting for women's rights, for women's liberation, what has been called the longest revolution, and which is going on in every country and every culture on the planet. Lots of news, always. So tonight, we are going to have our Feminist News Roundup in a few minutes, and let me tell you what the show is going to be about. We're going to be focusing mostly on a very strange, and I'm afraid rather ominous, development going on in many parts of this country, where a number of states, I think 5 or 6 so far, with maybe close to 20 soon going to join them, have been passing legislation that is taking aim at what they're calling divisive teaching of U.S. history. Particularly, of course, they're targeting what they are misnaming a critical race theory. I say misnaming because it's barely taught in public schools. It's an academic discipline. But that has become a catch-all term for teaching that accurate but unpleasant truth about U.S. Treatment of black people, for instance, is going to create angst and other psychological problems for children learning about it, and that it is moreover un-American, and all kinds of other name-calling of what is basically part of critical race theory, which simply teaches you that slavery, 400 years of it, of enslaving African people and extracting their free labor, is a big part of the wealth that built this country. You're not supposed to say that, apparently, in education arenas anymore. So many of these laws also talk about race and sex, or racism and sexism, as being part of these disturbing elements that our children must be protected from. And that's a part of these laws that is not getting very much attention. Tonight we're going to be giving it some attention. We will have as a guest, our second guest will be Dr. Altheria Caldera, who's a scholar, writer, and equity activist. She's a policy fellow with the Intercultural Development Research Association, or IDRA. And in the name of IDRA, she has submitted testimony against Texas Senate Bill 3, which seeks to ban the teaching of critical race theory and associated subjects. She's also an incoming assistant professor at Howard University and has written an article entitled Anti-Critical Race Theory Laws Attack Women and People of Color. So we're going to be looking at all of that in our second segment. In our first segment, right after the news, we will be speaking with activist journalist attorney Jessica Mason Piego, to whom we often turn when we want to understand what's happening to our laws, particularly those affecting women, via the Supreme Court and other courts. So she regularly appears on Joy of Resistance, and we will be speaking about the upcoming Supreme Court case in Mississippi, which we've done several shows on, and the fact that about 12 state governors and attorney generals has now signed an amicus brief to that Supreme Court case, Mississippi versus, I believe it's Dobson versus Mississippi. Jessica will tell us the exact name of the case. And they have signed on. A lot of people have signed on to briefs basically demanding the overthrow of Roe versus Wade, which was the landmark decision that made abortion legal in this country after, of course, years of activism to produce that result in 1973. So we are at a very serious point in the right of women to control our bodies, and we'll be speaking with Jessica Mason Piego after the news and getting her take on what the lay of the land looks like in the Supreme Court. Before we do any of that, we are going to go to our feminist news segment. So please stay tuned for that. For the first time in 40 years, a budget bill has passed the House that does not include the infamous Hyde Amendment, introduced by Senator Henry Hyde in 1977 as the first major attack on Roe versus Wade's 3 years earlier legalization of abortion. The Hyde Amendment banned any use of federal funds to pay for abortion, cutting off access to the newly won right for low-income women who receive Medicaid, a federally funded program. Later, health care for other women on federally funded health care plans was added to the list, such as women on reservations, women in the military, women in prisons, etc. Now, contrary to its 43-year-long longevity, the Hyde Amendment was never actually a law, but merely a budgetary rider that could have been scuttled at any point had there been the political will to do so. Republicans consistently voted to add it to every budget, and Democrats didn't fight back, often using it as a bargaining chip, such as when President Obama assured Republicans that federal funds would not go for abortion under his administration if only they would pass his health care bill, the Affordable Care Act. Another amendment often is side-by-side with Hyde. It's the Weldon Amendment, which started to be invoked in 2005, that bars funding for the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services from going to federal agencies and programs or state and local governments that, quote, discriminate against health insurance plans or healthcare professionals that refuse to, quote, pay for, provide coverage for, or refer people for abortions. It has been included in an annual spending bill for HHS alongside the Hyde Amendment since 2005. I hope people heard in that the victimization that is written into it, the victim profile that is given to those who refuse to allow women to obtain our constitutional rights. Okay. But this unprecedented event is not a victory unless the budget gets through the Senate and the Hyde Amendment is repealed permanently. It may yet reappear this year if Democrats bargain it away again in budget negotiations. So we are looking forward to how that is going to all pan out. And the New York Women's Law Center has a petition on its website that you can sign that basically urges Congress to permanently ban the Hyde and the Weldon Amendments. And you can access that at ACT, as in act, ACT.NWLC, ACT.NWLC, to sign that petition and keep up the pressure.
All right. Thank you, Fran. And on to our next story, which, as Fran mentioned before, Alabama Governor Kay Ivey and Attorney General Steve Marshall have joined 11 other governors and 23 other state attorneys general in asking the Supreme Court to overturn Roe v. Wade. The officials filed amicus briefs in a case involving a Mississippi abortion law that has been blocked by lower federal courts and will be now heard by the Supreme Court later this year. As of July 29th, 228 Republican lawmakers, including 44 senators and 184 House members, had also signed amicus briefs relating to the case, arguing that states should have the right to set their own abortion policy. In 2018, the Mississippi state legislature passed the bill prohibiting abortions after 15 weeks of gestation, and Jackson Women's Health Organization, the only remaining abortion clinic in Mississippi, filed a federal lawsuit challenging the law, which was then upheld by several lower courts. Now, however, the Supreme Court will consider whether pre-viability prohibitions on abortions, such as Mississippi's ban, are in fact unconstitutional. And given the current 6-3 conservative majority on the Supreme Court, this could lead to a new precedent that would effectively overturn Roe v. Wade. And that would, in turn, trigger laws in many states that would criminalize abortion. And I believe later in the show, we will be speaking much more about this with Jessica Mason-Pieklo. So please stay tuned.
Yeah. Halsey, I'm going to ask you to read the next story also, and then I'll get into the Venezuela story, the one about the walkout at
Absolutely.
The Gamer company.
All right. On Wednesday, July 28th, hundreds of employees at the California-based video game company Activision Blizzard staged a walkout to protest the company's handling of sexual harassment and discrimination charges. The previous week, on July 20th, the California Department of Fair Employment and Housing, or DFEH, sued the company over its pervasive, quote, frat boy culture, end quote, where female employees were continually harassed, discriminated against, and underpaid. The lawsuit follows a two-year investigation that discovered that one Activision Blizzard employee had referred to his hotel room at a work-related convention as the Cosby Suite, which, of course, is a reference to the serial rapist Bill Cosby. And it also found that many other employees were aware of that nickname. The investigation by the DFEH also found numerous examples of discrimination against pregnant women and women of color, retaliation against employees who spoke out about discrimination and harassment, and widespread examples of sexual harassment and assault that in at least one instance are alleged to have resulted in the suicide of a female employee. Activision Blizzard's chief compliance officer, Frances Townsend, who had previously served as Homeland Security advisor to George W. Bush, denied the allegations, saying, quote, "We cannot let egregious actions of others and a truly meritless lawsuit damage our culture of respect and equal opportunities for all employees," end quote, according to the magazine Axios. Organizers are demanding that the company overhaul its hiring and promotion processes, publish salary and promotion data publicly, and hire an outside firm to audit the executive team. According to Zoe Schiffer, writing in The Verge, the employees are also asking that forced arbitration be removed from employment contracts. This move would, by one anonymous employee's estimation, quote, "remove the feeling of isolation and allow for more solidarity with one another," end quote. Activision Blizzard is one of several major video game companies that have come under scrutiny for their sexist company cultures, In 2019, the California DFEH was involved in a similar lawsuit against Riot Games. And just last year, a survey revealed that a quarter of Ubisoft employees had seen or experienced sexual harassment, which then called attention to a toxic culture for women that many say may go back nearly a decade.
All right. And we have some good news out of Venezuela. Gender parity is to be guaranteed for Venezuela's municipal and state elections this coming November. Under Venezuelan law, political parties must present an equal number of male and female candidates and must alternate them on their lists. Tania D'Amelio, rector of Venezuela's National Electoral Council, which oversees all elections in the country, said, quote, "Women have been empowering themselves in decision-making spaces, so it should also be that way in municipal chambers and in the legislative councils. Seeing a bit of the history of previous processes, we must remain united in organizing for these political purposes," close quote. D'Amelio was elected to the National Assembly twice before being named to the National Electoral Council. Women were required to have legislative parity in the first years under former President Hugo Chavez, but the law was revoked in 2000. The law was then reinstituted in 2015, but not enforced, and the right-wing opposition coalition opposing the government quickly announced its opposition to this rule. But last week, on July 29th, the National Electoral Council announced at a forum it hosted on gender equality that the law will now be enforced. National Electoral Council, right, announced it will be enforced. On the ballot in November will be 23 state governorships, 335 mayoralties, and state and municipal legislatures. Venezuela currently is behind many Latin American countries in women holding legislative seats, with only 32 of 167 seats in the current National Assembly held by women. At least 10 other Latin American countries have a legislative quota for women. One of those, Bolivia, in 2015 had a parliament with 53% women. And that is some of the worldwide feminist news. We present a portion of the many stories about women fighting to move forward, women fighting to not lose ground, the worldwide struggle that is going on for women's equality. Very much in play, very, very active. And tonight our stories were written and read by Halsey Hazard and myself, Fran Luck, and one of them was written by Pete Dolak. So, we thank you for listening to the news, and we are going to go on with our show in a few minutes, and we're going to be speaking with Jessica Mason Pieglo about the new developments in the Mississippi case that may result in the overturning of Roe versus Wade. So please stay tuned for this. Again, I'm having a little problem hearing you. I'm going to ask you to really speak up. We're changing our technology all the time, and all these things keep happening. So I can hear you now.
Okay, so I'll make sure that the mic is close to my face. I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm okay. Got another show together with both disturbing and a few exhilarating elements. And we'll just do our best and get through it, you know, and inform people, because people need to be informed. So we have, let me first tell people who you are, of course. You are Jessica Mason Pieglo. You are an activist, journalist, attorney, and you have been reporting with us and to us about Supreme Court issues for a long time. You were the vice president and editor of the Reproductive Rights blog. I'm looking at this without my glasses, if you would believe that. Well, you can fill it in. Rewire, that's right, rewire.news. So we're so glad to have you with us again. And we have some dark clouds on the horizon, right? We have 12 governors now and assorted attorney generals have signed on to a brief urging the Supreme Court, which will take up a case that could result in the overturning of Roe versus Wade in October, to go ahead and do just that, overturn Roe versus Wade and all associated abortion laws that have been built on that constitutional law. So I wanted to ask you to come on and kind of bring us up to date on what that is about and what you think it means.
Sure. So to get your listeners caught up to speed, the Supreme Court, like you said, is going to hear a case in the fall that asks the justices whether or not they want to overturn Roe versus Wade. We really are at that moment. I've been on the show many times and talked about how this was sort of work. You know, conservatives were really working on this as a strategy, and here it is. And one of the things that we have seen as a result of the Supreme Court taking up this case is that now the anti-abortion forces are really saying the quiet part out loud, right? For a long time, they would say things like, well, we don't really want to punish people who have abortions, for example, or we just want to, you know, we want abortion to be returned to the states, for example, and let folks in their own respective states do with it what they will. And so now we're actually seeing conservatives say things like, no, women who have abortions should be jailed. And it's not enough to send the question of whether or not abortion should be legally accessible to the states. We want the Supreme Court to rule that it should be banned entirely. So this is an amplification and a mark of privilege by many Republican lawmakers. They are really hoping that, as far as they're concerned, that they're on the right side of this political fight when the Supreme Court issues its decision, which will be next summer, going into the midterms.
Oh, I didn't realize it was that far away. I know they're taking up the course in October. And mm-hmm. will it take an entire year until there is a decision?
So, yeah, I mean, the court will hear the case sometime in the fall. It hasn't been scheduled yet. And then they will be issuing decisions like they do every year. And this is a big case, so we can expect it to come at the end of the term, which would be basically this time next year.
Okay. So we are going to be sitting on the edge of our seats, or are we going to be doing more active things than that, do you think?
I mean, one of the good things is that, you know, with the court taking up this case and the process just in and of itself being slow because that's how Supreme Court cases work, it gives folks the opportunity to agitate. You know, members of Congress have spoken about, you know, the Women's Health Protection Act and codifying Roe versus Wade. That would be a good start. You know, there's opportunity for folks to put pressure on lawmakers at the federal and at their state levels, too. You know, we are seeing, in response to the Supreme Court take up this case, states, you know, in places like New Jersey, New York, here in Colorado, lawmakers are really trying to do what they can to shore up reproductive health care protections in the event of a decision that goes in the other direction from the Supreme Court. So we don't have to just sit here and gnash our teeth. We can pressure lawmakers to say that, you know, the threat is now and it's real and it's not hypothetical. We're not being hysterical. You can no longer dismiss us. The threat is at the court.
Right, right. And, yeah, you're right. We have a lot of states now that have put very solid Reproductive Rights Acts into place, so women in their states will be protected, but certainly not all. And many other states have trigger laws which will make abortion automatically criminalized if the Roe versus Wade should be overturned. They are all ready for that. And as one of our recent guests, Robin Marty, was spelling out, many women will be criminalized for trying to terminate pregnancies, women of color, poor women, other all marginalized groups will be criminalized, and that's something that we may have to get ready for. How do you see that as panning out, certainly in a legal sense?
Robin is absolutely correct that is an inevitability if the Supreme Court were to overturn Roe versus Wade or even take another really healthy whack at abortion rights. And in fact, this is another area that's not a hypothetical. We've seen some prosecutions already play out, and to the point where there is a legal defense fund for that has been started by legal advocacy groups for women who face investigation and criminal investigation and prosecution for potentially terminating pregnancies on their own. Right now, if a prosecutor is very intent on finding a way to try and shoehorn a criminal code to, basically determine that a developing pregnancy is a person, then that really opens the floodgates for criminalizing all sorts of behaviors. We've seen women charged with reckless endangerment when, they were in a car crash for not wearing a seatbelt, for example, and they're pregnant. That happened. Prosecutors tried that in Tennessee, for example. So we don't have to dream up nightmare scenarios. They're already existing.
They're already here, and they've been here for
places.
Quite a while.
Yeah.
Of course. And we remember Purvi Patel, and we remember Bebe Shue, and and other women who were victimized, who were accused of some sort of infanticide, even though abortion is completely legal still, officially, right, in this country.
Exactly.
So it's going to be a difficult time. It was very much anticipated, of course, when Amy Coney Barrett was appointed to the Supreme Court by dear number 45. And the whole, Republican cabal that arranged all of this and has been preparing for it for a very long time. What is very strange is that there are positive things happening at the same time, such as the fact that the Hyde Amendment has just finally been dropped after 43 years, right, from being included in successive budgets. And the Hyde Amendment keeps poor women from being able to have funding to pay for abortion because it stops Medicaid or any federal funds for paying for it. So we have this sort of note of a great leap forward, almost, maybe, at the same time. We're sort of hanging over the abyss in this other way. It's quite maddening and confusing, isn't it?
It really is. And also, I think it's such a good opportunity for us to remind folks that the opposition to legal abortion is really the, like, biggest example that we have of minority rule in this country, right? Abortion rights are uniformly popular. Folks want abortion to remain legal, even if they personally are uncomfortable with folks terminating pregnancies in certain situations. People understand that this is a constitutional right, that we should not take steps backwards. And yet, as a result of a sustained political campaign and thanks to gerrymandering in conservative states, we have lawmakers who are just out of step with their constituents, so that we can have things like you mentioned. For the first time in over 40 years, the Hyde Amendment, this language that restricted poor people from accessing abortion coverage if they happened to be on Medicaid, that's gone. That's a huge leap forward. And yet we have a Supreme Court that could, within a year, really make this a very difficult place to be, particularly if you happen to be in the Deep South, for example, and are needing to access abortion care. So it is a time of political whiplash when it comes to reproductive rights, without a doubt.
Yeah. And I think that's also why they are so intent on distractions, incredible panic mongerings, such as the attacks on education going on in so many states under the guise of somehow rooting out destructive aspects of critical race theory, which are supposed to turn children all anxious and traumatized, which is all very ridiculous. But it is working. They are manipulating parents, and this is also growing. And as you're pointing out, so importantly, it's by people who are in the minority in this country. And that's going to be the subject of our next interview. So it somehow all fits together at this point, and the struggle continues. So, Jessica Mason-Pieklo, I really want to thank you for being on Joy of Resistance and helping to explain something more about this moment, getting people to have a picture of it. I look forward to a great uptick in activism, in militant activism, to defend our rights that we are, major rights that we are so in danger of losing. And if knowledge is power, we hope we've moved it ahead a little bit tonight. Are you there, Jessica? Can you hear me?
Yes, I am. Yes. Thank you so much for having me on. It's always great to talk about the case.
Yeah. I very much appreciate you being here to keep us apprised. So we'll be talking later, and I look forward to all of the news in Rewire.news, which is the blog that you are vice president and editor of, and it's a very important reproductive rights blog. Okay. Have a good night.
Thanks so much. You too. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye. And we are going to very shortly be speaking with Altheria Caldera, Dr. Altheria Caldera, who is a very important scholar and activist and has been very active in what we were just beginning to discuss, the struggle to stop a very big kind of panic that is being promulgated by Republican forces and is just sweeping over many states. We're going to be talking about that and its effect on women in just a few moments when we get back. This is the Joy of Resistance, Multicultural Feminist Radio, WBAI. My name is Fran Luck, and we bring you news from the front lines of feminist struggle every week. So please stay tuned.
Broken home, love was rare and life a fight. Then I came across a young boy who would hold me tight and leave me lonely with the colors from my wound. Sometimes he could not tell the difference between night and day. Intoxicated days had rearranged his way. Then my father, my own father, took a turn one day from my mother to the colors of my womb. Men dare try to say when I might or when I may make the decisions that they set me up for anyway. Insult my mind, my rights, the issues of my womb.
Hello. Dr. Altheria Caldera, are you there?
I'm here.
It's good to hear your voice. Welcome to Joy of Resistance.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask you also to speak up a little because I'm just having a problem at my end getting the correct volume, and I appreciate that. So, Dr. Altheria Caldera is a scholar, writer, and equity activist. She's a policy fellow with IDRA, I-D-R-A, or the Intercultural Development Research Association. And in the name of IDRA, she recently submitted testimony against a Texas Senate Bill 3, which seeks to ban the teaching of critical race theory and associated subjects. She is an incoming assistant professor at Howard University, and she has written many, many articles. I have counted hundreds in what you sent me, Altheria. Many, many more than we can name. But I'm just going to mention the recent one that caught my attention and provoked me to call you. It is called Anti-Critical Race Theory Laws Attack Women and People of Color. And, of course, there is a much mention of both race and sex, the teaching of those subjects, as somehow divisive in many of the laws. So we're going to be looking a little bit more at that aspect, as well as the whole deal. So I'm just going to start by saying that many states, including Oklahoma, Tennessee, Texas, Iowa, New Hampshire, have in the last few months passed legislation that takes aim at the divisive nature of teaching accurate U.S. history, I would say, particularly targeting critical race theory, which has become a catch-all term for teaching, unpleasant truths about U.S. history that a lot of right-wingers don't seem to want us to be talking about. We have 20 states considering such legislation. And when you really get into it, it's kind of scary because it's very much like it's almost like a resurgence of this McCarthyite, America, right or wrong, and you will be punished, in this case, defunded and banned and fired if you don't conform. So with that as a very general introduction, let me ask you, who just testified to the Senate in Texas, which has passed House has passed it, but the Senate rather has passed it, right? But the House is still on a protest. They are not coming back because they don't want to make a quorum, if I understand it correctly. But I would like you to introduce the subject by telling us some of what you had to say to the Texas Senate about why you oppose such a bill coming to Texas.
Well, first, I want to thank you for having me on tonight and giving me an opportunity to shed light on this subject that is often misunderstood. And this misunderstanding is leading to a considerable amount of unnecessary controversy. So the bill is problematic for several reasons, one of which, well, mainly, is because it is discouraging teachers from integrating accurate, authentic history into the curriculum in favor of curriculum that gives a glorified history instead of a real history. And I believe firmly that students need to know the truth of the country's founding, of the country's history, and the current events that are still being shaped by a country that has been founded on racist principles. And that's what these bills are trying to avoid, having these very necessary conversations. And they are being proposed by legislators who confuse patriotism with blind loyalty. And that's one of the things I said in my written testimony, that it seems as if they want to create students who leave schools without being able to critique this country, this nation, and its structures in any meaningful way.
Yeah, it is definitely the banning of any kind of criticism, and in the process of that, much history is actually being forbidden, which is very, right? 1984 comes to mind, et cetera. It's very, very scary running amok. Go on, please.
Today is James Baldwin's birthday. And he is an author who I really, really respect, and I enjoy his writings a lot. And one of the quotes that he is most well known for is, I love America more than I love any other country, which is why I have the right to critique her. And I think that is just as solid a form of patriotism, in fact, more so than non-critique, than this blind love and supposed, just that we have this faithfulness and this loyalty to this country without being able to accurately account for the nation's sins.
Right. Yes, Thank you. Thank you for reminding us of James Baldwin's birthday, and those are indeed very profound words. But when up against this kind of hysteria, they often don't prevail. I'm very interested in some of the language and concepts being used to promote these laws, and many of these laws have passed, and I wanted to just go through some of the effects. There is the claim that subjects such as white privilege or male privilege create guilt or anguish in children, and that is why the subject must be forbidden. And I do want to say that critical race theory is not actually taught to children. It's an academic, right, adult college subject.
Yes.
So the whole thing is full of this kind of falsehood. But it's also being said that Marxist ideology, that critical race theory is a form of Marxist ideology, and that, of course, is kind of not true at all. Simply
right.
Not true. It's a scare tactic. And oh, my goodness. It really reminds me of the, again,
know,
the anti-communist
Fran,
witch hunts. Yeah, go ahead.
You know, Fran, it is all a scare tactic.
Yeah.
It is all designed to incite the right. God forbid we do anything that would cause their precious babies to cry, right? That will cause them to feel any sort of guilt or responsibility, which is not what critical race theory or any sort of equity-related teaching does anyway. When it is done correctly, it does not instill fear or guilt in students.
Mm-hmm.
It is designed to help students learn about their role and responsibility in
mm-hmm.
correcting a system that has caused wrong to so many mm-hmm. people. So
and
about,
I know,
it's about responsibility and this idea that we're part of a democracy that and that we're responsible for making this democracy better.
Mm-hmm. I know you have been a teacher. You started out as a high school teacher, and I've taught also. And it seems to me that if you're worried about little white boys and girls, for instance, thinking that they're evil because they're part of this white race that has caused oppression of black people, for instance, that there would be many pedagogical things you could do about that. For instance, you could just reassure
yes.
them that they were not born into any kind of evilness, you know, that's not what it is about, that they are fine, that we're, you know, et cetera, et cetera. Why don't you fill some of that in?
Yeah, I think that if they're concerned that teachers are doing this, and I have to say, as a teacher educator who is responsible for going out to watch my students teach, and so I'm in schools all the time around the Dallas-Fort Worth area, I don't see teachers, for one thing, even having these difficult conversations about race, but definitely not doing it in a manner that is abusive or violent to students. However, if that is the concern, the way we meet that need or the way we address that concern is not by forbidding the teaching in general. The way we meet that need is by making sure that teachers have the capacity to go into classrooms and interrogate or examine race and racism in ways that do not lead to students feeling guilty or, as some legislators have said, contributing to the increase in suicide among today's youth, which is not true at all. But
right.
if that is the concern, let us focus on helping teachers to develop racial literacy, which I define as that willingness and that ability to navigate these conversations around race and racism. Let's work on that, but don't ban the teaching of it. Don't ban these discussions, and don't try to, you know, whitewash history as if these things never happened. I was conducting focus groups a few weeks ago, Fran, and I had one of these focus groups was with a group of youth ages 12 to 17. And these are students who said to me they want true history. They don't want to be told that they're these heroes, these founders are heroes that were infallible. No, these are students who want to be told the truth. They want to know that these people were human. They made mistakes. They did good, but they often lived contradictory lives. Students right. deserve to know that truth.
Right, and of course we can trust teachers to be age appropriate because teachers are very skilled when it comes to dealing with children, which is also something that's being ground under the rug here, which brings me to the title of your article, which is Anti-Critical Race Theory Laws Attack Women and People of Color. And I think that scant attention has been paid to the fact that there is also an aspect here that is very threatening, really, to the rights of women. And can you please talk about the content of that article and what you are bringing to our attention about teachers, for instance?
Sure. I'd love to. I think it goes back, or it is rooted in what you just said, that teachers can be trusted to do, to employ pedagogical strategies that are age appropriate, right? But let's think about who's making these decisions. And then you ask yourself, do they really trust teachers? Because these teachers are majority women, right? And the legislators
yes.
who are making these decisions are white men in most legislatures throughout this country. So the question to ask is, do they trust women to do their job? Or do they feel like, or they feel like they have to police women doing their work? And so
yes.
these bills suggest that they have to police women's work, right? They can't trust teachers who are almost eight out of 10 women. Think about that in this country. They can't trust these women to act justly on behalf of our children. That is what they're saying.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. Very important part of it. And now some of the teachers' unions have come out and said that they're going to be taking cases. The National Educational Association and Randy Weingarten have come out and said that they're going to be defending teachers because they do see this as an attack on the rights of teachers. So
yes, absolutely.
I'm glad they're stepping to the plate. Now, many of the laws contain the phrase racism or sexism, with the teaching of either of which is seen as, quote, divisive and leading to all of this somehow traumatization of children. Why do you think they are saying and sexism? They obviously thought about that before they put that in. Where do you think that kind of leads us?
I think it goes back to a point that I made in the article that you mentioned, and that is white male dominance. Oftentimes we think about, we as in scholars like me who examine race, we recognize immediately the ways these laws are racist, but we don't as often connect these laws to sexism as well. And the reason, and so we see white dominance, we see white supremacy, we hear about white supremacy, but there is a key word there that is missing for me, and that word is male. I think that you can't extract one from the other when you're talking about state legislatures, because these state legislatures aren't just white, they aren't just male, they are comprised mainly of white males. So when we have white male dominance, we can't just look for instances of racism. We have to always be willing to expand that examination to consider sexism as well, because frequently they go hand in hand.
Yeah.
When I study race, I am quick to then question how does this affect women, because these same men are making these decisions about the teaching of race and the teaching of sex. And it is to me, Fran, is really simple. It is to maintain their dominance. These are white men who have a history of power and authority. And anything that seeks to threaten that, is they will attack. So they will attack teaching about racism. They will attack teaching about sexism. Because you know what it does? It reveals them. It sheds light. It sheds light on their work.
That's right.
And they'd rather be in the dark.
That's right. And also, the law in Texas, the second bill, right, which is worse than the first bill, right, SB3, but it was replaced by SB3739 or something, has a long list of subjects that will be eliminated. They are no longer part of the required curriculum. And they include things like lessons about the suffragist movement, the writings of Susan B. Anthony, many other writings about the Civil War, about slavery, and on. They are systematically removing those voices that could inform about the real history of this country. And that definitely includes a lot of female figures and a lot of history, which makes me wonder, it makes me realize that little girls going to school are not going to get the information they need about the history of oppression of women in this country, which would help explain to them some of the situations that still exist in this country.
You know, I listened to that. That debate. It was in the State Affairs Committee, the Senate State Affairs Committee, and I listened to every word of it, and I've even gone back to listen to the video that has been archived on the website. And one of the things that the person who sponsored this bill said is that these strike-throughs aren't meant to suggest that teachers can't teach these topics. Well, even if that is true, let's say for instance, that is true. And it is partially true, but it is partially untrue. Some of the things that are struck through, he said, is because they're already in the TEKS and they won't be removed from the TEKS. And I should probably clarify, TEKS stands for Texas Essential Knowledge and Skills. So what he said was that these things are already in the TEKS, so that's why they're being struck through in this bill. That is only partially true. Because IDRA, the organization where I've just completed my fellowship, has done this analysis, and we have evidence to show what are those things that were struck through from SB3 that they claim are already in the TEKS, but they really aren't in the TEKS. So I think moving forward, we really have to look at what is in these TEKS, what is being taken out of these TEKS. And if it's true that these things that are struck through on the bill are already being taught. Now, I want to go back and mention something else related to this bill and in connection with what you're saying about women being extracted from SB3. One of the things that we as an advocate proposed in this bill was when we talk about the founding of the country, the current language says the founding fathers of the country. We recommended, and it made it through in SB 3979 in the bill that the governor signed. It made it through that it's changed. The amendment says that it will be changed from the founding fathers to the founding fathers and mothers and other founding persons. That's something else that was struck through on this bill. We have to ask ourselves why. Why do they not want to acknowledge that women played a role in the founding of this country as well? And what does that say to little girls who are learning about the birth of this nation?
Absolutely.
If we can't learn about the founding mothers and other founding persons.
Absolutely. Well, I think that, you know, we only have a few more minutes, Altheria, and we are speaking with Altheria Caldera, who is a scholar and activist and a great activist, really, for people's rights, and is working against this blizzard of bills that are playing on the ears of parents. And, you know, it's a smokescreen. It's a smokescreen because these people are not really offering people anything. So they have to distract us by revving us up as if we're going to war with some sinister force that they're going to save us from. That's really what this is about. And in the meantime, they're defunding all kinds of teaching in Boise State University got $400,000 or so cut from their classes that were social justice classes. They want to get rid of that, which has resulted in the cancellation of 52 classes, including ethnic studies, folklore, studies of different societies, et cetera, et cetera. Very rich group of classes has just been cut. Just as examples of the dangers of these kinds of bills and why they must be fought and must be fought with the truth.
Yeah.
And speaking of that, I'm afraid we're out of time. You have certainly shed light on what the truth of this is tonight, and I hope that we can speak with you again as this progresses, because it really,
I should say, digresses.
Anyway, please give us a last sentence or two, and then we're going to have to say goodnight.
I think that you said the key word a moment ago when you call these bills dangerous. They're dangerous, they're regressive, and they will not further the egalitarian principles that we would like to see this country live. And it is up to us. I mean, we can't be silent, and we have to unite around the efforts to resist these bills, because they will hurt our children in the long run.
Absolutely. And hurt the country, hurt the ability of this country to tell its citizens, to engage with its citizens in truthful exploration of our history. Altheria Caldera, I really want to thank you for being on Joy of Resistance and for your work in you know, you're in the fields of struggle right now in this. And I want everyone to be very aware of what is going on. We are not immune from this in New York City. You are in Texas, but, you know, we are one country and everything spreads everywhere. Anyway, thank you once again. And I wish you success with the work that you continue to do. And congratulations on your appointment to Howard University.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And you're welcome. And I hope you have a great evening.
Thank you. You too.
Bye-bye.
All right. That wraps it up for our show tonight. We're going to go out with some more of – oh, no, we're going to go out with White Men in Black Dresses by Sandy Rapp, I believe. And we will not be here, actually, next week. We're going to be out of town. We will be back on the 23rd, and we will continue with bringing you the very best and most important front lines of the struggle for women's liberation going on throughout the world. So thank you so much for listening.
One of the denominations more perfect is than some. Afraid of them all, their strength will amaze you when they're backed to a wall. They're about in high places, many lives they command. They have smiles on their faces and blood on. It will tell them what is good.
Dear WBAI listener, we can certainly use a little help from our friends. After years of falling behind under new management, Pacifica has now gotten its financial papers in order and can apply once again for grants. That means WBAI, which is owned by the nonprofit Pacifica Foundation, can also apply for funding. And we are looking for a pro bono grant writer to help our 61-year-old station by writing grants for us. If you have time, expertise, and interest, please contact Bertol, our station manager, at bertol@wbai.org. You'd be helping to ensure the stability and growth of this historic listener-sponsored radio station. With details, please email bertol@wbai.org. That's B-E-R-T-H-O-L-D, bertol@wbai.org, with Grant Ryder in the subject heading. Many thanks. Many, many thanks. This is listener-sponsored WBAI New York.